Pope Leo XIV takes his first apostolic journey, and our EWTN expert analysts say his trip delivered real-world results.
I'll be bringing you to Turkey and here to Lebanon with an in-depth look at Pope Leo's first foreign trip, including his meeting here with thousands of young people in the heart of Beirut.
Foreign correspondent Colm Flynn shares highlights from Leo's travels. A beautiful voice that graced the National Eucharistic Congress last year is silenced by sickness. What happened to this remarkable singer just months after this appearance, and how prayer has helped her fight back?
She just did little things, and it makes us all feel like being a saint is attainable.
And deep devotion to the little flower brings thousands to venerate the relics of Saint Therese of Lisieux. EWTN News in Depth starts now.
The enthusiasm we feel in our hearts expresses God's loving closeness, which brings us together as brothers and sisters.
On his first overseas trip as the head of the Roman Catholic Church, Pope Leo XIV highlights the need for unity and peace. Traveling to Turkey and Lebanon, he visited ancient cultures with a deep history of faith and emphasized the importance of living together in harmony. Welcome to EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. Elements of this first foreign trip were planned during the pontificate of the late Pope Francis, with a focus on strengthening Orthodox Catholic ties, an issue of special interest to him. But Pope Leo's warmth, personality, and sense of mission made this journey all his own. There were many key moments of this trip. In Turkey, Pope Leo called the country a holy land where the Old and New Testament meet. He held high-level meetings with the Patriarch of Constantinople, Bartholomew I, and signed a document pledging greater unity and a joint theological commission of Catholics and Orthodox. He also attended the commemoration of the 1,700th anniversary of the Council of Nicaea at an ancient site known as the birthplace of the Nicene Creed, which we recite every Sunday Mass. On the second leg of his trip in Lebanon, Pope Leo stressed the importance of peace in a country which faces the stresses of war and economic collapse, as he met with leaders of both the Muslim and Christian communities. He concluded his trip with a mass for tens of thousands of people at the Beirut waterfront, closing his six-day visit in a nation that has the largest proportion of Christians in the Middle East. On his flight back to Rome, Pope Leo took part in one of the most anticipated customs of apostolic journeys, the press conference aboard the papal plane. In his first ever return flight exchange with journalists, he discussed the Holy See's peacekeeping efforts in the region. During the brief exchange, Pope Leo took six questions from reporters, answering in either Italian, Spanish, or his native English, depending on the expected audience. He first expressed his belief that a sustainable peace is achievable in the Middle East. When a Lebanese reporter asked him if he will use his contacts with President Donald Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu to help broker an end to the region's conflicts, Leo responded that those conversations have already begun.
In fact, I've already, in a very small way, begun a few conversations with some of the leaders of places that you have mentioned, and I would intend to continue to do that personally or through the Holy See, because the fact is that we do have diplomatic relationships with most of the countries through the region, and it would be our hope, certainly, to continue to raise that call for peace that I spoke of at the very end of the Mass today.
Pope Leo also spoke of the need for peace in Ukraine and shared his hope that the next apostolic journey will bring him to the African nation of Algeria, the birthplace of his order's founder, Saint Augustine of Hippo. In a few moments, we'll have insights into the impact of Pope Leo's trip with our team of expert analysts who say he achieved some real results. But first, a more comprehensive look at our Holy Father's journey from beginning to end with our foreign correspondent, Colm Flynn, who is on the ground in both Turkey and Lebanon.
This was going to be a closely watched trip from start to finish, the first international trip for Pope Leo XIV. And as soon as he landed in Accra, the capital of Turkey, the spotlight was on. His arrival in Turkey was official. A guard of honor, a red carpet, and an escort towards the presidential palace. But Turkey, being a Muslim-majority country, with only 0.05% of the population Christian, the first thing that strikes you is the lack of crowds to welcome the Holy Father. In fact, there were no people lining the roads, no banners, no fanfare. And we asked people on the street what they thought of the papal visit, and there was a mixed response.
I look at it positively. There is no problem with a religious leader coming to our country. I'm a peaceful person, and I respect everyone.
If our nation's founder Ataturk didn't look on this kind of thing positively, and if the sultans weren't in favor either, then we, even if we don't know everything, must all see this as something that is not good.
At the presidential palace, traditional and religious Turkish music was performed by the military band. And inside, the Pope met with President Erdogan and other state authorities before delivering his first major address of the trip.
In a society like the one here in Turkey, where religion plays a visible role, it is essential to honor the dignity and freedom of all God's children. And this has personal, social, and political implications.
By the following day, the Pope had arrived in Istanbul, where outside the Cathedral of the Holy Spirit, Catholics had gathered to catch a glimpse of the Holy Father.
It is a great joy for me to be with you.
And in his speech, Pope Leo encouraged them to see their small numbers not as a weakness, but as a strength, and never lose hope.
Among the most beautiful and promising signs, I think of the many young people who come knocking at the doors of the Catholic Church with their questions and concerns. In this regard, I urge you to continue the good pastoral work that you are doing.
After visiting a care home for the elderly run by the Little Sisters of the Poor and spending time greeting the residents one by one, Pope Leo boarded a helicopter for a 30-minute flight to the ancient town of Iznik and the site of the Council of Nicaea 1,700 years ago. Standing with the Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew, who is seen as the spiritual leader for all Eastern churches, Pope Leo spoke about the divisions among Christians.
We are all invited to overcome the scandal of the divisions that unfortunately still exist, to nurture the desire for unity for which the Lord Jesus prayed and gave his life.
We believe in one God.
Then Pope Leo, with the Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew, recited the creed together.
Eternally begotten of the Father.
The following day, visiting the Sultan Akman Mosque, better known as the Blue Mosque, he stepped inside, removed his shoes, and walked in his white socks across the vast carpet. But unlike his predecessors, Benedict XVI and Francis, Pope Leo chose not to pause in visible prayer. And later, a spokesperson for the mosque, speaking to journalists, said that he had invited Pope Leo to worship, but the Pope had politely declined, saying he was there to visit. On Pope Leo's final day in Turkey, he visited the Armenian Apostolic Cathedral, and in a country that still struggles with its past, the Pope made a carefully but unmistakable acknowledgement of the Armenian people's suffering.
This visit provides me with the opportunity to thank God for the courageous Christian witness of the Armenian people throughout history, often amid tragic circumstances.
And with the message of peace having been repeated again and again throughout his visit, his time in Turkey had come to an end. And he departed Istanbul International Airport for Lebanon. And just after 3:45 p.m. local time, Pope Leo touched down in Beirut and was greeted on the red carpet by the President and Prime Minister of Lebanon. And despite the heavy rain, crowds waved Lebanese and Vatican flags. Families with children, elderly people, and even Hezbollah-affiliated scouts lined the route. It was a strong welcome to a country with a Christian population estimated to be around 40%. At the Babda Palace, under tight security, Pope Leo delivered his first major speech on Lebanese soil to a hall filled with political leaders and representatives of Lebanon's many religious communities. He began with the words of Jesus.
Blessed are the peacemakers.
He acknowledged what he called a highly complex and uncertain regional situation, with daily Israeli attacks, the risk of another war on the southern border, a crippling economic collapse, and the presence of more than a million refugees. But he praised the resilience of the Lebanese people.
You are a people who do not give up, but in the face of trials, you always know how to rise again with courage.
The following morning, high in the misty mountains of Aniya, once again the faithful braved the rain outside the monastery of Saint Moran. Inside the small stone grotto, a choir sang a hymn in Arabic and Syriac, and then the Holy Father knelt in silence. From there, the Pope travelled down the road to the Shrine of Our Lady of Lebanon, overlooking the Mediterranean. And when he stepped inside the vast basilica, 2,700 bishops, priests, religious sisters and pastoral workers erupted into applause. It was an emotional meeting where religious shared their testimonies of living through last year's war. Pope Leo presented the shrine with a golden rose, a rare papal honour and the first ever bestowed on Our Lady of Lebanon. But the most joyful and emotional moment of the day was yet to come. As evening fell, Pope Leo travelled to the seat of the Maronite Patriarchate, where more than 15,000 young people had packed the hillside square. Some had even walked for miles to get there.
It's also a big blessing to be among the first countries here that the Pope is visiting.
It restores my faith, actually, and gives me more hope towards a better future and a more peaceful future, actually.
Taking to the stage, Pope Leo first greeted them in Arabic.
Assalamu alaikum. Peace be with you.
He listened to the testimonies from the young people. Stories of unemployment, of war, of shattered dreams, and of the temptation to emigrate. Then he delivered a powerful message to the young people.
You have hope. You have time. You have more time to dream, to plan, and to do good. You are the present, and the future is already taking shape in your hands. You have the enthusiasm to change the course of history.
The following morning, in contrast with the roar of the young people, Pope Leo XIV stood in silence. Under a grey morning sky, the Pope stood beside the ruined grain silos, still scarred from the 2020 port blast, where 220 people were killed and thousands more injured. He stood and bowed his head in prayer. And finally, at Beirut's waterfront, a sea of Lebanese and Vatican flags waved in the wind as an estimated 150,000 people gathered for an open-air mass. Stepping from the Pope Mobile to thunderous applause, the Pope delivered one of his strongest appeals of his time in Lebanon. He was speaking to a crowd that had suffered, where many had fled violence in the south or lost their homes in the economic collapse. With that, his first international trip, a six-day mission of peace stretching from Turkey to Lebanon, came to an end. At Beirut's international airport, Pope Leo climbed the stairs of his ITA Airways flight. He turned at the top and he waved goodbye to Lebanon. Reporting from Ankara, Istanbul and Beirut, Colm Flynn for EWTN News in Depth.
To help us understand the religious, diplomatic and geopolitical significance of Pope Leo's visit to Lebanon and Turkey, we're joined by two exceptional expert voices. Frank Rocha is EWTN News' senior Vatican analyst. He has covered the Vatican for nearly 20 years. Alberto Fernandez is an EWTN News contributor and a former U.S. diplomat. Gentlemen, thank you both for being here. Frank, I want to start with you. What is something new we learned about Leo's leadership style from his first apostolic journey?
Well, I think we saw what we've been seeing for the few months that he's been Pope and now on a world stage, which is the exceptional confidence and self-assurance that he shows in this job, which he very few people expected him to have only a short time ago. And very low-key, very calm, very serene. I thought it was an interesting moment when he went into the Blue Mosque and the muezzin invited him to pray, and he just said, "No, that's okay. I'm just going to look around." Again, it was a very delicate point that was very controversial with Pope Benedict and then with Pope Francis, and he handled it very matter-of-factly, offhandedly, and no repercussions, no tensions.
Right. And we'll get to that mosque moment a little bit later in the discussion. But Alberto, first, the National Catholic Register published your latest commentary this week titled "Pope Leo's First Apostolic Journey Delivered Real World Results." Alberto, what are those results?
Well, the biggest one was in Lebanon, where he spoke very forcefully and realistically about peace. In fact, Lebanese commentators said that he spoke much more realistically than the Lebanese politicians about it. And once the Pope left, the Lebanese government announced that it would, for the first time in 34 years, send a civilian diplomat to meet with Israelis in the ceasefire talks. This happened shortly after the Pope's visit, and then the Lebanese government announced that there will be a second session of that. That's a very tangible thing that happened immediately after the Pope's visit and very much in sync with the language that he used.
Right. Very consequential. Frank, during a wide-ranging in-flight press conference on the way back to Rome, Pope Leo weighed in on a number of diplomatic matters, including U.S. matters, one being that he urged against a U.S. incursion of Venezuela. Let's take a listen.
It seems there is the possibility that there be some activity, even an operation, to invade Venezuelan territory. I truly believe that it is better to look for ways of dialogue, maybe pressure, including economic pressure, but looking another way to change, if that is what they want to do in the United States.
Frank, are we seeing Pope Leo, our first U.S.-born pope, becoming more vocal on U.S. political matters? What did you make of his comments on the plane and how we're seeing him engage with the Trump administration right now?
Well, it's funny, yeah, because when he was elected, being especially because he's an American, the expectation in many quarters was that he would be, in a sense, this foremost critic of the Trump administration on many things. And of course, Pope Francis had been very critical of the Trump administration on things right up almost to the end. Pope Leo has made it clear how he feels, for example, on the migration question. There was a little bit of a hiccup there. In fact, he gives these press gaggles outside of Castel Gandolfo occasionally. And it was actually a question from EWTN when we asked him about U.S. politics. And after that, he seemed to back away. The following week, he was asked about immigration raids. And he said, I don't want to comment on U.S. politics. But then a week or two later, he started again. So we seem to be seeing him develop his communication strategy in real time. And he seems to have found his footing and decided that, yes, he is going to weigh on these important issues when he thinks so. And again, I think he seems to be showing a knack for doing this in a kind of way that doesn't make things explosive. It doesn't increase the tension. It kind of calms things down a bit. Mm-hmm. So he manages to say these things without creating a firestorm. Mm,
that's a difficult thing to do. Alberto, Pope Leo, as we mentioned, visited Istanbul's Blue Mosque. And while he did take his shoes off, he did not stop to pray, as his predecessors, Pope Benedict XVI and Pope Francis, had done. An imam of the mosque says he did invite the Pope to pray, but he declined. What do you read into that moment and the message and repercussions that it carries?
Well, I think it was absolutely right what he did. And I think he walked a fine line successfully, which was he showed true respect for his hosts. He showed true respect, deep respect for Islam, something which he has said many times and in fact continues to say so. But there was no pandering. There was no hint of kind of false equivalence, you know, we're all the same, everything's the same, I respect you, I don't respect myself, you know. There was respect for Islam and self-respect, which I think is a very powerful message in the region.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Frank, we did hear Pope Leo speak an increasing amount of English, it seems, particularly with members of the media on this trip. As a longtime Vatican journalist, how significant is this? And being that English is not only his native language, but it is one of the most accessible languages, what do you think the Pope's strategy is about when to and when not to use English?
Right. Well, okay. You know, in an international context here, he was never going to speak Turkish because he doesn't have, I don't think, as far as we know, he speaks that language. When Pope Benedict XVI went to Turkey in 2006, he spoke in French and in English. You know, French was once considered the international language. And so that's a appropriate. I think when Pope Leo, at the beginning of his pontificate, seemed to be using English sparingly in some international, for speaking to some international audiences, but sometimes he seems concerned to be acting as the Bishop of Rome. For example, at World Youth Day, even though he had a very international audience, he only spoke a few lines of English. It was mostly Italian and Spanish. But I think in an international context like this, and I think you mentioned, and so he seems to be increasing the use of English, and I think you mentioned that he spoke to the press, and that to me was very significant because heretofore the unofficial language of the Vatican press corps has been Italian, and so Pope Francis, Pope Benedict, for example, who's not a native Italian speaker, would address the press on the plane in Italian. It was just understood, and so this is a big shift that now he's speaking to them in English, which makes more sense because that's the language of international media.
Right. Alberto, final moment with you. We have less than a minute, but from a diplomacy perspective, what was the most significant moment that you extracted from this trip, whether it was a speech or a gesture?
Well, I've already mentioned the peace talk, but in addition to that, I would highlight one that I think was very moving to audiences, certainly in Lebanon, was his reaching out to the victims and survivors and family members of the Beirut bomb, port bomb blast 5 years ago. A terrible tragedy that has never been fully explained. No one's been punished for it. There's been zero accountability. And his real honest compassion with the family members, I think, moved a lot of Lebanese and also reminded them of the need for justice, not just for peace.
Mm, absolutely. Thank you for highlighting that. Frank and Alberto, thank you so much.
Thank you.
There is much more ahead in this edition of EWTN News in Depth. Stay right there. Next, from the heights of worship at the National Eucharistic Congress to the mysterious health scare that put her in the hospital.
The story of the husband and wife Catholic music ministers who feared illness would silence her voice forever.
You take nothing away, just talk to the little flower, ask her to be your friend, get to know her, and entrust yourself to her, because she'll be your like life coach.
And thousands flock to a rare U.S. tour of the relics of St. Thérèse of Lisieux on this 100th anniversary of her canonization. Rehearsal before a major appearance at the National Eucharistic Congress in Indianapolis in the summer of 2024. Lauren Moore and her husband Dave, in charge of more than 200 musicians who brought the power of sacred music to an event that inspired thousands of Catholics around the country. The National Eucharistic Congress was a major life event for everyone involved, including those on the stage and behind the scenes. Organizers had to ensure the program, musical performances, daily adoration, and masses all went smoothly. Musicians Lauren and Dave Moore were among the key players who spent years planning and preparing for this huge event in the life of the Catholic Church in America. But the Moores could not know the health tragedy that would hit them just months later, and what it would do to impact their faith.
Lord is my shepherd, there is nothing I shall want. The Lord is my shepherd, there is nothing I shall want.
Her beautiful voice soared throughout the stadium in Indianapolis at the National Eucharistic Congress in the summer of 2024. Lauren Moore and her husband, Dave Moore, founders of the Catholic Music Initiative, were responsible for the musical program at the five-day Congress. Dave was the event's music and liturgy director, composed new music, and booked a wide variety of Catholic musical artists. They both spent countless hours rehearsing and then performing before the 60,000 faithful who attended. By all accounts, the Congress was a huge success, and the inspiring music was a large part of that. The Moores are well-known music ministers in North Texas, where Lauren is a cantor for the Diocese of Dallas's televised mass, regularly records sacred music, and sings sacred chant for the Hallow app. They are credited with helping to grow the culture of praise and worship in the diocese in conjunction with the Office of Youth, Young Adults, and Campus Ministries. But just 6 months after the high of the National Eucharistic Congress, Lauren was hospitalized in the intensive care unit for 2 months with a mysterious illness, apparently triggered by a family-wide bout of flu in January. Dave was always there by her side. A strange numbing sensation had swept through her body. She could not stand up or walk, and she struggled to speak. As a paralysis spread throughout her body, Lauren was worried it would rob her of her ability to sing. She was eventually diagnosed with Guillain-Barré syndrome, a rare autoimmune disorder that attacks the nervous system. That diagnosis gave her medical team a path forward for treatment. Working through excruciating pain, she eventually moved to an outpatient rehab hospital where she learned to walk, talk, eat, and sing again. And then, 1 month ago, having once feared she would not have the strength to ever sing again, but setting a goal for herself to continue to give God glory and praise, Lauren returned to the stage for the first time. The audience at the Meyerson Symphony Center in Dallas was filled with priests who administered to her, nurses and doctors who had cared for her, friends and well-wishers, all waiting in anticipation of hearing her voice once again.
What an honor. Lauren and Dave Moore join us now to discuss the faith journey they have been on in this last year, from the highs of the National Eucharistic Congress to the lows of uncertainty and poor health that made them more resolved than ever to praise and worship God. Lauren and Dave, thank you so much for being here. Lauren, first, I want to ask you, how are you feeling today? What is the status of your Guillain-Barré syndrome?
So I'm still in recovery. Even though I can do a lot of the things that I used to not be able to do, I am still on the journey ahead, but it's, every step is a test of God's faithfulness throughout this journey.
Amen to that. Dave, your wife is obviously your partner in your life, but she's your partner in your music ministry as well. You two share your lives together completely. What was it like for you as her husband to watch her suffer for so long with a mysterious illness?
I don't have words for it. It just, this year we learned that hope isn't about crossing your fingers. It's about firmly planting your feet on the ground, which we found very fitting in this Jubilee year of hope, because the only thing you can do when you're completely helpless and you don't have answers is you exude the virtue of trust in God. And I was trusting that his plan was greater than anything I could imagine. But ultimately, I just had to hope and trust.
Yeah. Mm. Even trust when it maybe didn't feel like you were trusting, that was, you know, when it mattered the most. And Lauren, I hope that this is not too personal or probing to ask, but I mean, here you are, this talented and successful Catholic singer, and you're open about how you want to use your voice to glorify God. So I'm wondering, in your time in prayer and reflection this past year then, why do you think God allowed for this illness to happen and for your singing, which is a good and beautiful gift, to be taken away from you for a period of time?
You know, I've never felt closer to the crucified Lord than being in the hospital bed, feeling the amount of pain. It was like my personal Garden of Gethsemane moment. Yeah. And I know that he allowed me to suffer to understand the suffering of others, to be able to offer up my suffering, because he really showed me that our suffering is never wasted. There's always a bigger plan. And for me, I didn't know if I would be able to sing again, work again, do the ministry that we feel called to in the same way. So it really was about total surrender to him and growing closer.
Mm. Yeah. That's beautiful. Maybe not fully understanding the plan, you know, this side of heaven. Dave, talk to us about the timing of all of this and the emotional roller coaster that it must have been. The fact that you two had this incredible experience leading music at the 10th National Eucharistic Congress for tens of thousands of Catholics, to then just months later, your wife being struck by a debilitating illness. What do you make of that timing, and how do you even begin to cling to your faith during that time?
You know, I think it, in all seasons of life, there's always a temptation to double down on what the world offers and to focus on, for lack of a better term, the Garden of Eden. But this season forced us to focus our eyes on eternity and to prioritize God and our family and our community and our faith. Mm-hmm. I think as creatives, I think there's another challenge in the world that you constantly are seeking discovery, and you're constantly trying to bring an offering to the church. And sometimes that offering is like the offering of the 5 loaves and 2 fish, and God takes it and he feeds his people. And sometimes the offering is like years of laboring over a fine perfume that gets dumped out on the feet of Jesus. And I think in this season, we realize two things: that the offering given in a pure heart, the suffering labored through with an honest, sincere heart of faith and hope and trust, God blesses that. And we learned that it, you know, lay down the need for discovery and allow God to develop you. Mm-hmm. I think he developed us this year through a forging of fire. Mm-hmm. And I'm so grateful that he used us to bring forth great fruit in the church through the National Eucharistic Congress. Mm-hmm. And I know that he has an incredible plan for the future. But he wants our hearts more than he wants to use us. Mm-hmm. And what he did this year was he fully solidified for us and fortified in our surrender, in our trust, in our hope. He brought us back into the Sacred Heart in a profound way that we're just grateful for the intimacy in prayer, in relationship with God. We've refortified our disciplines of faith. We've turned to the sacraments in a more profound way. And God has met us in our meekness. And that's been this year.
That's beautiful. You know, we think we have to work for God's love, but you're just saying it's about that relationship with him. Lauren, how meaningful was it then to make your triumphant return to the stage 1 month ago at the Meyerson Symphony Center? Tell us about that night.
You know, it was like entering a place of just complete awe. It was a miracle. It was an absolute miracle that this event happened. Because when I was in the hospital bed, I just felt the Lord saying, like, I'm still not done with you know, your gifts, and they're going to still be used to glorify me. And, you know, you're my daughter, and I want to, you know, show that joy and show the resurrection moment. Yeah. And that's what it felt like. It felt like this huge resurrection moment, you know, spiritually in my life and for the life of our community. Yeah. It was just, there was so much joy, and I just sang into this new place of hope, and that's where I sing from now.
Yeah.
That is so beautiful, and I am so grateful for your testimony, for your vulnerability, our prayers for your continued recovery, but thank you for sharing this really hard-earned wisdom. Thank you both, Lauren and Dave Moore.
Thank you.
News headlines are next in the Week in Review. Intense scrutiny this week in Washington about the Pentagon's airstrikes against alleged drug smuggling boats in the Caribbean. Lawmakers mounting concerns about the legality of those strikes tops the Week in Review. At the center of the controversy is the way Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth has handled the strikes and whether or not he and others in the chain of command have committed war crimes. More than 20 vessels have been targeted by U.S. forces, and more than 80 people on those boats have been killed since early September. Without providing evidence, the Trump administration says they are all drug-running boats manned by narco-terrorists. At issue is the very first strike off Venezuela on September 2nd. After the boat was initially hit, two survivors were spotted in the water amid boat wreckage. A second strike was ordered and killed them. According to published reports, Secretary Hegseth had given general orders to kill everyone. However, according to the Pentagon's own rules of engagement, targeting people who are defenseless and unable to fight is a war crime. During a cabinet meeting this week, Hegseth defended the decision-making.
But you didn't see any survivors, to be clear, after that first strike.
I did not personally see survivors, but I stand, because the thing was on fire. It was exploded in fire, smoke, you can't see anything, you got digital. This is called the fog of war.
As soon as it appears, apparently to him, that maybe somebody did something wrong, this guy, unlike any other leader I've ever worked for, turns around and runs in the opposite direction. It's embarrassing.
On Thursday, the admiral in the chain of command who reportedly ordered that second strike was questioned by top lawmakers in the House and Senate Armed Services Committees. Emerging from the classified briefings, lawmakers said the investigation will continue. The head of the Archdiocese for the Military Services USA has urged the end of the U.S. government's approach to halting drug boats and killing suspected drug runners. In a statement released this week, Archbishop Timothy Broglio writes, "Our nation has a long tradition of responding to injustice, liberating the oppressed, and leading the free world. We cannot tarnish that reputation with questionable actions that fail to respect the dignity of the human person. I call on our nation's leaders to respect the consciences of those who raise their right hands to defend and protect the Constitution by not asking them to engage in immoral actions. Show the world our respect for human dignity and the rule of law." And as the investigation continues into the deadly airstrikes in the Caribbean, this week the Defense Department's Inspector General released his report faulting Secretary Hegseth's use of the Signal app to share sensitive details about U.S. strikes in Yemen. Signal is an encrypted messaging app. Hegseth texted details of the strikes in real time earlier this year as U.S. troops were conducting the operation. Though Hegseth claims the report, quote, totally exonerates him, the report indicates otherwise. The investigation says Hegseth received what was classified military information, and the sharing of it on his personal phone could have put the lives of U.S. troops at risk had the chat been intercepted. And while ordering strikes on apparent drug-running boats, the administration says pose a threat to Americans, President Trump has pardoned the former president of Honduras, who is serving a prison sentence in the United States for his role in a massive drug-smuggling ring. Juan Orlando Hernandez was president of Honduras from 2014 to 2022 and was sentenced in U.S. federal court last year to 45 years behind bars for protecting drug traffickers who smuggled 400 tons of cocaine through Honduras and into the U.S. Both Republican and Democratic members of Congress criticized the pardon. Some called Hernandez a narco-terrorist. President Trump defended his decision, saying Hernandez was the victim of a witch hunt under the Biden administration. The Catholic political prisoner and media mogul Jimmy Lai has been behind bars in a Hong Kong prison for 5 years now, while still awaiting a verdict from his trial in August. Among several charges, he is accused of conspiracy to publish seditious material in defiance of the communist Chinese government. Lai's defenders say the charges are politically motivated. This week, his daughter Claire sat down with Armance Alvarado for an exclusive interview and update about her father.
The delay after delay after delay was clearly meant so that people would forget about my father and so that it would crush his spirit. With the good Lord as his guide, he has, you know, his spirit remained just as strong.
A devout Catholic and free speech democracy advocate, Lai has been in solitary confinement suffering inhumane conditions. He turns 78 on December 8th, the same day as the Solemnity of the Immaculate Conception. An extended version of this interview with Claire Lai will air on EWTN News Nightly at 6 p.m. Eastern on Monday. The Supreme Court heard oral arguments on Tuesday for a lawsuit brought on by a chain of pro-life pregnancy centers in New Jersey. The case could have major implications for the thousands of life-affirming centers across the country. In 2023, New Jersey Attorney General Matthew Plotkin issued a subpoena against First Choice Women's Resource Center, accusing the faith-based chain of deceiving clients and donors by falsely suggesting they offered abortion referrals. He asked First Choice to hand over detailed information of its donors, but the centers sued him in federal court, calling the subpoena an act of intimidation and a violation of its First Amendment rights. It's a technical case about whether First Choice can challenge the subpoena in federal courts rather than state courts. But justices on both sides of the ideological spectrum seemed sympathetic to its argument.
An ordinary person, one of the funders for this organization or for any similar organization, presented with this subpoena and then told, but don't worry, it has to be stamped by a court, is not going to take that as very reassuring.
It says the AG subpoenas have the force of law, and if a person fails to obey the subpoena, the AG may apply to the Superior Court and obtain an order adjudging such person in contempt of court. Now, I don't know how to read that other than it's pretty self-executing to me.
Justices will issue their decision in the coming months. A ruling could impact not only pro-life pregnancy centers, but any nonprofit or advocacy group that faces state or local investigations. First Choice has drawn support from a diverse group of organizations, including the U.S. Bishops Conference, the Trump administration, and the American Civil Liberties Union. One of the largest retailers in the U.S. is filing a challenge against President Trump's tariffs. Costco has sued the administration in the U.S. Court of International Trade in an attempt to secure a refund on tariffs it has paid should the Supreme Court strike down Trump's sweeping levies on nearly all imported goods. Costco says many of its products are imports, and the tariffs have made it difficult for the retailer to keep prices affordable for Costco customers. Costco joins dozens of other companies suing the Trump administration to safeguard a possible refund. The Supreme Court has fast-tracked its ruling on the tariffs, but has not indicated when that ruling will be handed down. Up next, a groundswell of enthusiasm as Catholic parishioners turn out for one of our church's most popular saints.
You think of her as the little flower, her little way, but she was just a powerhouse, and I think people really do recognize that.
Why do so many Catholics feel a special bond to St. Thérèse of Lisieux? We hear from several of the faithful as they come to venerate her relics during a U.S. national tour.
For many Catholics, venerating the relics of a favorite saint can be a profound once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. This fall, tens of thousands of U.S. faithful had that chance, thanks to a national tour of the relics of St. Thérèse of Lisieux. Catherine Rubano brings us on tour in this Catholic Life report.
For me, I experienced a really deep peace that I wasn't expecting. I was like, it was just surreal.
A prayerful peace surrounded Sacred Heart of Jesus Catholic Church in Winchester, Virginia on Black Friday. It's not a feeling you might expect on one of the busiest shopping days of the year, but over the Thanksgiving holiday, this church had a special visitor.
This has been on my calendar since July, and I'm very, very excited to finally get the opportunity to meet one of my best friends.
For 3 days, Sacred Heart hosted the relics of St. Thérèse of Lisieux, one of the most beloved saints of the last century. It was one of the last stops on a months-long national tour of the relics throughout the U.S., the first in 25 years. Father Bjorn Lundberg, pastor of Sacred Heart, says thousands of faithful traveled from across the eastern United States to see the relics, some even spending their Thanksgiving in Winchester.
We were contacted in advance by people from New York, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, North Carolina, Florida, Ohio.
These devotees of all ages and from all walks of life waited in line for a moment in front of a grand reliquary containing pieces of Therese's bones. They came bearing roses and rosaries, prayer intentions, and thanksgiving.
She's an amazing saint, and just wanting to be more like her in trust and in childlike.
I like it because people call her the little flower.
For such a popular saint, Therese lived a short, hidden life of suffering and confident faith. She was born in Normandy, France in 1873 to Louis and Zélie Martin, now two saints themselves. She lost her mother at the age of 4, and throughout her childhood, she struggled with sensitivity and health issues. When she was just 15, Therese entered the Carmelite monastery in Lisieux, intent on becoming a great saint despite her littleness and imperfections. She sought what she called a little way to heaven, a path to sanctity marked with complete confidence in God's abundant mercy and doing the most ordinary things with the greatest of love. Though she passed away at 24 years old to tuberculosis, her little way has inspired countless souls around the world, thanks to her autobiography, Story of a Soul.
By the second page, I knew that God wanted me to be a Carmelite. So now I laugh when I, during the relics visit, when I would see people buying her autobiography, I would say, oh, be careful. That's a very dangerous book. You could read it and it can change your life.
Father Donald Kinney is a discalced Carmelite friar. He not only led the organizing committee for the first relic tour in 1999, but this year's tour as well, which commemorates the 100th anniversary of Therese's canonization. He notes the significance of this anniversary falling on the Jubilee year.
Pope Francis, in his document to proclaim the Jubilee year of hope, he wrote, "Hope has a face, and that face is Jesus Christ." And that's what, in different words, that's what St. Therese feels about the Lord.
The relics traveled to 40 stops in 11 states from coast to coast.
We want to fill churches and fill hearts. And that's what we've done. Everywhere we've been, the churches have been full, no matter how large. My favorite pastime when the relics were here would be to sit in a church and just to watch people come up by the hour to venerate the relics. And everyone in every place, and we could not have planned this, everyone was very touched and moved.
The tour began at the National Shrine of the Little Flower Basilica in Royal Oak, Michigan, where joyful crowds welcomed the saint back to the U.S. on her feast day. In Southern California, the Carmelite Sisters of the Most Sacred Heart of Los Angeles hosted the reliquary. The relics made a visit to the Basilica of the National Shrine of the Immaculate Conception in our nation's capital after numerous stops in the South and Midwest. The Little Flower spent this final week of her tour in Miami. The relics leave the U.S. on December 8th.
I thought, wouldn't it be neat if she could come to the parish, but it was a total dream.
More than a year ago, Father Lundberg approached another organizer about hosting the relics.
And Therese says it's nothing but confidence we should have. So I confidently asked him, presuming we couldn't get her. But I said, if it's possible, we'd love to host her, because in our region, we are near West Virginia, Pennsylvania, Maryland. And so the only spot they had open tentatively was over Thanksgiving. And so I begged and pleaded, and thankfully it worked out.
Along with all-day veneration of the relics, Sacred Heart also held a votive mass in honor of the Holy Face of Jesus. From parishioners to staff to visitors, everyone EWTN News spoke to had a personal connection to the Little Flower.
Working for the parish, it's hard because I'm focused on the administrative aspects and the logistical aspects, and every once in a while the feeling would wash over me that it's Therese.
It's been an experience like none other, but I'm sure that in her little way, she's going to continue to move all our souls in the direction of our Lord, our Lady, and the saints.
Father Lundberg says St. Therese is a powerful witness for our times.
People don't have hope, or they either struggle with these extremes of I don't believe in God, or I have a hard time believing in God, or I have this terrible impression of God. And Therese is kind of like this Navy SEAL for our time. She's the tip of the spear to re-encourage in us and reanimate with us with confidence.
Though the relics will soon return to Lisieux, the graces imparted through them will continue to transform hearts and minds.
When the relics are here, as they are now, that's part one of St. Therese's visit. Part two comes when she leaves. That's the time for us to begin to continue our prayers for conversions and vocations.
And even if you missed out on the relic tour, it's never too late to befriend one of the greatest saints of modern times.
Even if you don't know her or not particularly connected to the Little Flower, I was not either. You know, get to know her. She'll change your life.
In Winchester, Virginia, I'm Catherine Rubano, EWTN News in Depth.
St. Therese, pray for us that we too may do little things with great love. Before we go today, a programming note about some exciting viewing we have lined up for you that will air in this time slot in place of EWTN News in Depth during the month of December. Next week, on December 12th, join us for the annual Mother Angelica Award. In celebration of the spirit of our foundress, EWTN will present the award to a recipient who most embodies Mother Angelica's love of Jesus. On Friday, December 19th, to mark the birthday of our late pontiff, we will air our special report, The Story of Bergoglio, the man who would become Pope Francis. We travel to Argentina to learn how his upbringing there shaped his papacy. Then, on December 26th, join us for our news special, America's National Eucharistic Revival. Catholics renew their faith in the true presence of Christ in the Eucharist during the 3-year revival that included pilgrimages across America.
Then, on January 2nd, EWTN News in Depth is back on the air with a new episode looking at the most important moments for the church in 2025, including the loss of one pope and the transition to another. And we will bring you some sweet news from our family right here at EWTN News in Depth. Our staff had what you might call a small baby boom in the year 2025. Pope Francis called it the year of hope, and we will tell you what we were thankful for in 2025 and introduce you to the little blessings that have graced our lives. Now, as we close this edition of EWTN News in Depth, we return to the Meyerson Symphony Center in Dallas, Texas, to listen once again to the beautiful voice of Lauren Moore as she made her return to the stage in praise and glory to God. Until we see you again, have a blessed Advent season.